Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock and Whitney Bank Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to me at david.lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at hancockwhitney.com. Today's panelists will be John Portwood, Chief Investment Strategist, Investment Directors Richard Chauvin and Jeff Tangest, and special guest and Senior Portfolio Manager Steve Solomon. And I, David Lundgren, will be Chief Investment Officer, will be serving as the moderator. This morning, I'm going to kick off things with a little discussion about Hurricane Harvey and the economic and market impact of the storm. But before I get into the numbers, it seems a bit insensitive to be talking about market and economic impact of such a devastating storm. Our Hancock Holding Company, our parent company, has offices from Houston to Tampa with our primary office locations on the Mississippi Gulf Coast and New Orleans. So we're no stranger to the toll these storms can take. So our thoughts and prayers are with the people of Texas. But as an asset manager, we feel it's our job to have a discussion and let our customers and shareholders learn about and understand what the economic impact might be. So with that, I'm going to talk just a little bit about the storm itself. There were some unique aspects to the storm. First of all, it made landfall three times. The first time was the Yucatan Peninsula as a tropical disturbance. It made landfall on August 24th in Rockport, Texas, as the strongest storm to make landfall in the U.S. since 2005. It was a Category 4 storm when it made landfall. And then it reentered the Gulf and then made landfall again near Cameron, Louisiana, on August 30th as a tropical storm. Some of the more interesting and devastating aspects of the storm, while there was a lot of damage from storm surge near the Corpus Christi area, a lot of the damage is going to be a function of the tremendous amount of rainfall that occurred in the northeast quadrant of the storm. As many of you probably are aware, there were not a lot of steering currents, and it allowed Harvey to kind of linger for days. And the wettest part of the storm stayed over the metro Houston area for at least 5 days. Some areas in the Houston MSA recorded 50 inches or more of rain. And just to give you some sort of comparison, the average yearly rainfall, so the average that you get in a full year at Houston's Bush Intercontinental Airport is 49.76 inches. So a lot of areas in Houston got that over a seven-day span. So just an incredible amount of rain and flooding that occurred that led to a lot of the damage outside of that Corpus Christi area where landfall first took place. I do want to give you just some information about Houston. Houston is the fourth largest city in the United States, and Texas is the second largest state. The Houston MSA has approximately 3 million jobs, and it's also one of the fastest-growing large cities when it comes to employment. The gross domestic product of Houston is about $500 billion. So if Houston was a country, it would rank in the top 20 by GDP. So obviously a very large economy that, in effect, paused or stopped for about a week. So that's not going to happen without there being some sort of economic impact, not only on the regional level, but on the national level as well. And unfortunately, we have a couple of storms that we can use as a guide to understand what that impact might be. And both of those storms, Katrina and Sandy, in terms of damage, the two costliest storms to ever hit the United States, not sure where Harvey is going to end up. It will be one of the costliest. It's too early to say whether or not it'll pass those two storms in terms of the amount of damage. But using those two storms as a guide, you're likely going to see many economic readings take a hit really over the next, call it, 4 to 6 weeks, whether we're talking about employment, consumer spending, inflation will rise really as a function of gas prices, industrial production. All of those will experience a setback. But again, using those other two storms as a guide, what we see in the months and even years to follow is that a combination of insurance proceeds, charitable donations, and government aid are going to act as a significant boost to the regional economy, that Houston area and all along the Texas Gulf Coast. As they begin to rebuild and as that money flows into the market, it can have the it almost acts as a stimulus package from an economic standpoint, only amplified within a specific region. So what you'll see on a national level, and it won't, it won't be as magnified or amplified as it will at the regional level, but on the national level, you'll see a bit of a dip over the next 4 to 6 weeks. And then as that economy recovers, you'll see a bit of a burst even on the national level from an economic standpoint. I'm going to really try and briefly touch on some sectors. Energy is an interesting story. Energy, historically Houston has been known as an oil town. They've done a lot to diversify their economy over the last few decades. But it still could be thought of as the energy hub of the United States. And things are looking more and more promising on this side. We had I think a lot of people, given past storms, you expect both the price of oil and gas to increase after an event like this. But because of the storm's path in the westernmost part of the Gulf, it's strengthened late. Really, a lot of production didn't come offline. And also, the country's, such a higher percentage is coming from shale. We're less dependent on Gulf of Mexico production or deep water production. That supply of oil really wasn't a problem. The real issue was from a refinery standpoint, where we had upwards of 20% of the country's refining capacity taken offline. So that's why you saw the price of oil basically hold steady, but you saw this big spike in gasoline. And we do think that in the next 2 to 3 weeks, it looks like production is coming online and refining capacity both at a pretty quick pace already. So I think within 2 to 3 weeks, you'll see gas back to where we were prior to Hurricane Harvey. So we'll continue to watch that. Just a couple other industries that I'm going to touch on. Obviously, there were a considerable amount of homes that received damage, and a lot of it from flood damage. I'm going to touch on two points to that. In terms of insurance, because so much or a higher percentage of the damage is going to come from flooding, it's not going to have that material of an impact on property and casualty insurance companies as some people might expect. Flooding is generally not covered by private insurers, but by government programs. So the liability of P&C companies is going to be less than you might expect, given the large amount of damage that's going to occur. Additionally, because we're talking about tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of homes either destroyed or damaged, obviously any companies related to construction materials, home improvement companies, appliance, et cetera, will probably see a bump in their revenues. And the last thing that I'll touch on is just autos. One thing that I think is going to be apparent is that this will be the costliest storm as it pertains to autos than any other storm in past history. Houston is a very car-dependent region. 95% of households in the region own at least one car. And estimates vary, you know, anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million cars destroyed. So obviously there's going to be a lot of replacement need, which should provide a boost to a lot of auto manufacturers. So I'm going to go ahead and pause there, stop there, and then turn it over to John. And John, you know, let's just talk a little bit about the economy from a national perspective. And we'll start with maybe, I'll ask you to start with the second quarter GDP. That number was revised up to 3%, so much stronger than expected. And then here in the third quarter, things were looking pretty promising from a GDP standpoint. Give us your, you know, we're two-thirds of the way into the third quarter. Give us your thoughts on that, and then, you know, anything you want to add in terms of economic impact from Harvey here in the third quarter and the fourth quarter, I think would be good. John?
Okay, Dave. The latest Atlanta Fed GDP Now estimate, and that's an estimate of what is happening currently. It's not necessarily a forecast. It really is an attempt to pick up, you know, what's happening in economic activity as the new measurements are announced. And as of last week, the estimate for the third quarter was 3.2%. That probably does not pick up a lot of the fallout from Harvey that will occur in coming weeks. So I guess a good guess for the third quarter, I'm talking about, a good guess for the third quarter now would probably be, say, 2.5%. That's roughly where consensus is, and probably the latest consensus numbers we see are not completely taking Harvey into account, so those consensus numbers should come down, but something less than 3% is probably a pretty good guess. Now, the first half of this year turned out to be a 2.1% based on what the latest, you know, changes in the second quarter of GDP would indicate, and 2.1% is roughly, you know, where the long-term trend has been ever since the Great Recession. We've talked a lot about how that is not likely to change anytime soon in terms of trend, and that's probably going to be the case. The recent numbers that came out on employment indicated that we're probably in the late cycle of our economic recovery, or our, you know, economic uptrend that has existed since 2008. Growth in the employment numbers peaked back in 2014, and the recent number that was 156,000 is really not very far out of line with what the Federal Reserve has indicated is necessary to take care of new entrants into the labor force. In fact, going forward, the San Francisco Fed put out a research paper recently that indicated, on average, maybe we only need 100,000 jobs per month going forward for a number of years to, you know, keep the labor force, you know, growing in line with new entrants. So it looks like people are going to have to get used to some very different numbers going forward to compare to what we've had in the past. But in any case, growth in employment peaked about 3 years ago, and we seem to be, you know, doing about what we should be doing, given where we might be, you know, in the, you know, in the cycle. Something else is happening that is also kind of interesting. Housing has slowed down. That's whether it's new home sales or construction of new home sales, permits and whatnot. And they're a little lower than what a lot of people have been estimating. It could be that we've seen a peak in housing as well as automobiles. Automobiles peaked at about a 17 million annual rate, I guess maybe 18 months, 2 years ago. And that's another sign of late cycle decline. But in any case, getting back to housing, the excuse for the recently relatively poor, not too bad, but relatively poor housing numbers is that there simply aren't enough houses, that the demand is there, but the supply isn't. Well, unfortunately, that story is being used in Canada, it's being used in the United Kingdom, it's been used in a number of places around the world to sort of explain away the fact that housing appears to have also entered a late cycle period in which the numbers are just not going to accelerate that much. So I would guess that, numbers for housing are down because the demand is also down. And that's probably one of those, stories that gets, circulated and cycled around that probably doesn't really mean all that much. But in any case, getting back to the growth story and the prospects for recession, we don't see any leading indicators that suggest recession is near. There really aren't, any numbers at all that suggest we're about to fall off a cliff. In the past, we've talked about 2% over, say, a couple of quarters in terms of growth was considered a precursor to a recession. that hasn't been the case for the last 8 or 9 years because we've had a lot of quarters back to back that were 2% or less and haven't had a recession, and it's probably because the growth rate is relatively slow. And in any case, as long as there's no major shock out there that can't be forecast at this time, we're probably likely to bounce along and muddle through, so to speak, with something of along 2% or maybe slightly more for the foreseeable future. At least we hope that's the case. Doing anything better than that would be long odds. I think the best case is probably 2.5, or perhaps quite a long time. But I guess that's basically the story, Dave.
Okay. Richard, one thing that could get us a little bit more economic growth than John discussed is meaningful tax reform. We've discussed this on several of our calls, and things continue to evolve. Do you mind giving us an update on the tax reform front?
Sure will, Dave. Yes, that's exactly why we like to spend a little time on this each month, is because it does potentially give us an opportunity to boost growth to some degree through a fiscal policy package that provides a more efficient economy, a little bit more relief for corporations as well as individuals. The latest view on the viability and the timing of a tax reform package getting through Congress this year or early next year is that there is a bipartisan desire to provide funding for Tropical Storm Harvey relief funds in Texas. And apparently there's a move to use that bipartisan desire to help to tie it to a bill that would include bundling that with a debt ceiling increase, which is a potential controversial issue coming before Congress this fall, as well as a budget resolution, which is needed to fund the government at least partially into the next fiscal year, which begins November 1st. If that is successful, the idea of bundling Harvey relief with these must-do laws, then it would avoid a prolonged fight over the budget and the debt ceiling, and if that fight can be avoided, it would therefore free up some valuable time that's otherwise going to be wasted on these controversial measures. So Texas aid may be used to kind of grease the skids during a window of time, and that opens up in October, November. So there's a two-month period there that might be used for the beneficial purpose of considering tax reform. If that 2 months is going to be used effectively, then there's three things that need to be done during that period. First of all, congressional leaders are going to have to find agreement with the White House on a broad outline of tax reform. What does it really look like? And there's been no real consensus on that, pre-election or post-election. Then the House and Senate are going to have to agree and pass a budget resolution authorizing what's known as reconciliation, and that means that nearly all Republicans will have to agree on the size of a tax cut that gets involved with this bill. We've talked about a little bit before about some of the things that could be done that would be possible with reconciliation, is that you get to avoid the 60-vote majority and could get down to a 51-vote majority under that set of rules. which makes it much more doable. And third, the tax writing committees are going to have to then produce or at least get a major start on an actual bill that can be voted on during that two-month period or shortly thereafter. But if the budget resolution can't be passed by about Thanksgiving, then you can probably view the window as being closed for this year because the government's going to have to return to the process of funding the government in early December. This doesn't mean that you won't see any kind of tax bill late this year or next year, but it probably dashes the hopes of anything significant passing that would include limiting deductions and cuts to the corporate tax rate, which is something the administration has been asking for. So this two-month window becomes pretty important to get anything significant done. So we'll see whether the Hurricane Harvey relief might be helpful in that regard. It's sort of cynical that it needs to be done that way, but it possibly could have a positive outcome if it is. So that's my comment on tax reform, Dave.
Okay. Sticking with you, Richard, obviously the news over the weekend, there was a lot of discussion about Harvey and Irma. But also big news was the continued rhetoric out of North Korea. It's reaching, a more worrisome level. Tell us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I will say that I had some comments prepared for this call late last week and early into the weekend, and I've had to throw a lot of those out. So I'm going to ad lib a little bit here because things really did change over the weekend, as many of you know. So following this test over the weekend of what was purported to be a hydrogen bomb, which is an underground test, I've really altered the thoughts on this because most of the comments I was going to make was sort of assuming that there were negotiations still going on between North Korea, South Korea, and the U.S. over the North Korean nuclear program. It's probable now that those talks are not happening. So what we saw over the weekend was Secretary Mattis making some pretty pointed comments, sort of a verbal warning that included a statement that said, not quoting, but to the effect of that the U.S. had no desire to dismantle or destroy the North Korean regime, but we had many options to do so. That was a pretty ominous statement, and we don't really know what backs that up because there have been many other comments made by others that we didn't have any really good military options here with this with the nuclear program without jeopardizing the lives of thousands and thousands of South Korean citizens. So we'll have to wait and see what the U.S. plans to do with this. It certainly is a major escalation of the situation. It was already escalated last week with the flyover of a missile test over Japan. It wasn't much of a reaction to that by either the U.S. or Japan, but certainly this is a more significant escalation of that. What's pretty significant here with this situation is that President Trump did accuse South Korea of appeasement with the comments that their new president made. President Moon Jae-in responded to president's criticism by saying that indeed Seoul Korea would not tolerate North Korean nuclear advances, but still felt that diplomatically it was still important to continue some talks to look for a peaceful resolution. So what this really shows is it's important to South Korea to avoid a conflict with North Korea. It certainly remembers all the lives that were lost in South Korea during the Korean conflict in the 50s. It wants to avoid that at all cost. Certainly that's not lost on the U.S. as well, but the U.S. priority is to prevent North Korea from acquiring a deliverable nuclear weapon that could reach the U.S. So these are opposing priorities, and the big question becomes which priority really takes precedence. And we could just say point blank, that, well, the U.S. priority is going to take precedence. We're a more powerful nation. We have more influence. So we'll put that interest, our interest first. We really don't know if that's the case or not. We might like to think so, but we really don't know. That's still an open question. We don't know if the U.S. would move forward with an attack on Korea without South Korean cooperation or participation or not. If the U.S. was to do that, was to say we will only consider an attack on North Korea with South Korean participation, then, and if South Korea doesn't want to participate, which would seem to be the case at least right now, then the U.S. is basically accepting North Korea as a nuclear power. And if that's the case, then it changes the entire balance of power in Asia for probably a long period of time. That's a pretty amazing thing to consider, but you have to at least consider the possibility that that could happen. But we kind of fall on the side of saying the U.S.'s interests are going to take priority, but I just don't want to say that that's an absolute certainty. I'm going to shift now with so many questions remaining on what the U.S. will do next, what South Korea will do. It's really sort of an unknown. I'm going to shift next to the economic consequences of where we are now and just hope and pray for the fact that there's a de-escalation of this situation. And if it does de-escalate, which would be wonderful, there's still some significant risks to the global economy, because we believe that the reason the president has been rather soft on China following his very tough comments during his election is that he wants to use China as a lever point to get North Korea to behave itself. But it may become more and more obvious, it's already beginning to, that China is not really interested in helping to the degree that the president wants. And if it becomes very clear that China is not going to be able to de-escalate and disarm or convince North Korea to abandon its program, then the president might just go ahead and impose trade sanctions on China, which has been his intent, or at least verbal intent, stated all along. And if that's the case, he doesn't really need any congressional authority to do that, as we've talked about in the past, and that could have pretty significant implications for global trade and the global economy. You could see a slowdown or recession globally if that was to happen, because certainly there'd be retaliation by China if that was to happen. So best I can say at this point is we'll have to keep watching this situation and hope for the best, but it certainly looks ominous at this point. And it's also interesting, as I close here, to say the markets have been very subdued about this. We haven't seen any significant risk-off trade developing. The interest rates have not changed dramatically. They've certainly not been declining significantly. They've already been sort of in a modest downtrend in recent weeks, and the stock market has been holding up fairly well. So there seems to be potentially some risk to the stock market if this thing does escalate, but so far there doesn't seem to be a lot of fear showing up in the markets.
Okay.
That's what I've got, Richard. At this point, Dave.
Yeah. And I would say that fear may not be showing up in the stock market, but it may be showing up a little bit in the bond market. But I'll let Jeff Tangus tell me if that's the case or not. It looks like, when you look at the 10-year Treasury, July 31st, we were sitting at 230. By the end of the month, August 31st, we're at 210, and it looks like we're trading a little bit below 210 this morning. Give us some insight on what's happening in the bond market, Jeff.
Well, I think you're right. Part of it is fear or concern, but there's a lot of moving parts going on here. Richard touched on everything political that's happening in Washington with the budget, and I'll just make a quick comment that the bond market is watching that pretty closely, but it doesn't appear that we're going to have any of the fiascos that we've had in years past between Republicans and Democrats using either the debt limit or the budget or something as a tool, at least not in the immediate future. It'll probably happen somewhere down the road, but not immediately. So that's probably not a, a real big concern for the bond markets at this point. The next thing that the bond markets are watching would be, of course, the Federal Reserve and what's going on there. And because of a relative soft spot in some of the recent economic numbers regarding employment, as well as wage growth, which continues to be kind of weak, the Fed is not going to raise a third time this year. Right now, the market's generally expecting sometime in the middle part of next year for the next Federal Reserve rate increase. So whereas we came into the year, as we have for the last several years, thinking probably three increases, looked like they got two in early, and another one may not happen for quite some time. There's a couple other things brewing with the Fed, of course. In February, Janet Yellen's term is up. And she's been giving some commentary that that would appear she thinks she's probably not coming back. So the bond market is keeping an eye on what's developing with the at the chair at the Federal Reserve. Other indicators that the bond market is really focused on, and probably the biggest reason why the 10-year rate is down so much since earlier this year, inflation expectations continue to drop precipitously. The biggest gauge that the Fed uses, a long-term indication of interest rates, or I'm sorry, of inflation over a five-year period out into the future, indicates something well under 2%, about 1.77%. is sort of what the long-term inflation expectations are looking at. The Fed wants 2% inflation, so raising interest rates in the face of inflation that is much lower than what they want is counterproductive. So that's probably going to keep the Fed on the sidelines longer rather than shorter. Beyond that, as you mentioned, the 10-year rate dropped over the last month about 20 basis points, a little less than 20 basis points, mostly on the news of the Korean conflict, as well as some soft inflation data. So it continues to be a situation where rates are more stable than most anticipated earlier this year, and the Fed is much more docile than most people anticipated. So we'll have to wait and see, but it looks like it's probably going to continue along this path all the way to the end of the year.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Going to turn to the stock market now and want to introduce, I mentioned earlier, this is Steve Solomon's first time on the call with us. Steve is a senior portfolio manager, long-term vet of the firm, is a co-manager of the Hancock Horizon Microcap Fund, and covers technology and telecommunications for our large cap strategy. Welcome to the call, Steve.
Thanks, Dave. And I'll try. I know we're
talk about the stock market. Interesting month. The S&P 500 basically flat. Small cap stocks down slightly. Tell us your thoughts on the month, and then what do you see going forward?
Okay. Well, you know, we continue our streak of mixed monthly results. Continued in August. The S&P entered that final week down just over 1%, mainly due to, you know, the things we've been already discussing, the geopolitical tensions, concerns over the debt ceiling. You know, we saw VIX spiking during the middle of the month, but then we had on August 25th, Hurricane Harvey hit Texas. And the markets viewed, you know, this catastrophic event as having the potential to bring at least the political parties together and help reduce the risk of that government shutdown. And since then, we've seen the president indicate that, you know, he's not going to shut down the government over the border wall funding. And it's looking less likely, at least for now, that we'll have issues, at least immediately, with the debt ceiling. So based on that, the market ended up rallying pretty strongly to close out August, bringing the indexes back to near record levels. VIX dropped off significantly and closed out the month at just over 10. If we look at what did well, what did not do well, domestically large caps were essentially break even. They were up 0.3%, but we did see a pretty good sell-off in mid caps and small caps, which were down 2% and 3% respectively. If we look at styles, growth, had another very strong month relative to value. For the month, growth was up 1.48%. Value was down 1.16%, a difference of 264 basis points. And we've seen that trend now for a number of months. Looking at sectors, technology and utilities, two very different sectors, led the way in August. Tech was up 3.5%. Utilities were up 3.25%. That probably has a lot to do with what Jeff was talking about, with the yields once again heading lower. So, you know, investors are searching for yield. On the negative side of the equation, energy was down over 5%. Telecom was down just over 3%. And interestingly, energy and telecom are now the only two sectors that have posted negative returns for 2017. All the other sectors are positive at this point. Turning to international markets, in August, we came awfully close to breaking the streak for positive monthly returns for the MSCI ACWI index. That index had a 1% gain over the last 2 days of the month, and that was just enough to eke out a positive return for the month. And why that's important? Well, for the first time since the ACWI's inception 30 years ago, the ACWI has produced positive returns for the first 8 months of the year. That has not ever happened. Historically, the ACWI has averaged 4 negative monthly returns per year. Drilling down a little bit deeper on international, developed markets were flat for the month, but emerging once again was very strong, up just over 3%. And frontier markets, which are the smallest of the emerging, were up 1.65%. And so now that second quarter's in the books, I thought it would be good to just give a quick recap on earnings and fundamentals. Operating earnings for the second quarter came in 12% year over year. Revenue growth was up 5.1% year over year, which is now above its long-term average of 3.9%. We had the highest percentage of companies beating revenue estimates in 6 years, 68% versus the 15-year average of 59%. S&P is currently trading at 21.2 times trailing 12-month earnings, 17.9 times next 12-month earnings, so still a little bit elevated, at least versus historical averages. If we look at sectors, energy is trading at the top of that at 28.2 times next 12-month earnings. Financials and telecoms are trading at the bottom at 14 and 13.4 times, respectively. And 43.6% of the S&P now yields more than the 10-year Treasury. If we take a quick look ahead, September has a well-deserved poor reputation. Since 1980, September has averaged a decline of 0.77% excluding dividends. That's the worst single monthly average of the 12 months. The only other month to average a negative return is August, but that's a more modest, minus 0.16%. But on a positive note, at this point, all 20 of the world's top economies are growing in 2017, which is the first time that has happened since 2010. The IMF forecasts that global growth will continue to improve into 2018. The only two regions that have yet to pass their previous peaks, emerging markets in Europe, continue to show good progress. And one final point, one positive aspect of the muted returns in August was with the continued rise in earnings that helped bring the MSCI Global PE back in the neighborhood of where it was at the beginning of the year. So, you know, basically prices remained flat, but earnings went up. That's a good thing as far as PE ratios go. So there's no doubt it's still trading at above historical averages, but the improvement in valuation is certainly a positive. And that's all I have at this point, Dave.
Well, great, Steve. Thank you very much for your insight, and thank you, everyone, for joining today. Join us next month when our call will be on Tuesday, October 3rd. Thank you.